From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! It's primary day in New Hampshire, where citizens, not journalists, are asking candidates the tough questions.
An Expose the Right activist asked Lamar Alexander if he would seriously consider Pat Robertson as his running mate. Mr. Alexander said that his criteria for a running mate are someone that he likes and someone he respects and someone whose views are a lot like his. And then he went on to say that he would consider Mr. Robertson as his running mate.
Pat Buchanan, he's no friend of labor, but because he's the only candidate talking jobs and trade, some workers are saying, go, Pat, go.
Pat Buchanan's the only person out there of both parties who is really putting his money where his mouth is, and that is the campaign to take back America and to put the American worker and family first, and I support him 100%.
That and more coming up on Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Pacifica's daily grassroots election show. In today's program, a look at the Christian coalition on the ground in New Hampshire, from school board politics to presidential primaries, and People for the American Way's Expose the Right campaign. Then a look at Pat Buchanan's record on social issues. While some call them conservative, many call them simple hate-mongering. And as Buchanan battles for the Republican win today, we'll debate his labor record. Does his anti-NAFTA pro-job stance mean he's pro-labor? Unions say no. Finally, New Hampshire's Living Wage campaign. Grassroots groups say the economy should be judged not only by numbers of jobs, but whether those jobs pay a living wage. Now let's move into the first segment. Every Tuesday on Democracy Now!, we'll be taking a look at how the Christian right is affecting the presidential campaign. Today we're joined by two people on the ground in New Hampshire. Galen Nelson is director of the New Hampshire Expose the Right campaign, which sends activists to candidate events to confront them with uncomfortable and pointed questions the media aren't asking. And we're also joined by Ken Coleman. He's a member of the school board in Merrimack, New Hampshire, who's fought efforts by the Christian right to push its agenda through public schools. And we want to welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning. Let's begin with Galen Nelson, director of New Hampshire's Expose the Right campaign for People for the American Way. What exactly is this campaign that you began in Iowa and are now doing in New Hampshire?
This Expose the Right campaign in New Hampshire, it's a voter education campaign designed to highlight the tremendous influence of religious right political groups and right-wing groups over the presidential primary process. And furthermore, to educate New Hampshire residents and, of course, Americans in general about the extremist anti-family agenda of those political groups.
How did People for the American Way get its start?
Norman Lear and other civic and religious leaders launched the organization back in 1980. Norman was actually filming a documentary in Texas about televangelists and was so alarmed by their vitriol and their intolerance that he decided to launch a national organization that would celebrate what we consider our real American values of tolerance and respect for others and a sense of community. Respect for diversity, and to fight the intolerant anti-family agenda of those religious right groups that have grown throughout the 80s in their strength.
So, Galen, let's talk about some of the questions that you've been putting to these candidates in New Hampshire.
Sure. We've asked the candidates a whole range of questions on a whole range of issues, everything from questions dealing with public education to abortion to Head Start, the Brady Bill, civil rights issues, and more often than not, the candidates have run from our questions, have waffled, and it's been very difficult to nail them down on a whole range of issues.
How do you actually do it? Where do you go to talk to the candidates?
Well, the candidates generally publish their schedules a few days before, a few days in advance, and you can find them on the internet, in the newspapers, sometimes by calling the offices to get their schedules, the campaign offices. And then we organize members of People for the American Way and people who have joined the Expose the Right campaign here in New Hampshire. And they join us at these candidate events and ask these very tough questions of the candidates.
Now, I've been seeing your signs on CNN. Every time I see the candidate in New Hampshire, it seems like almost every time, I see this bright orange sign in the background that says expose the right. But I've never seen CNN interview one of you to ask you what it is you're doing. So why don't we talk about some of these questions that you've been asking? For example, when one of you asked Lamar Alexander about whether he would consider having Pat Robertson as a running mate.
Right. That was actually in a candidate event in Londonderry, New Hampshire, and an Expose the Right activist asked him if he would seriously consider Pat Robertson as his running mate. And of course he said, well, my criteria for running mate are someone I like and someone I respect, someone whose views are a lot like mine. I respect Mr. Robertson, and I'd be glad to consider him. Now, this is a man, Pat Robertson, a man who has said that the separation of church and state is a lie of the left. He said, you are supposed to be nice to the Episcopalians and the Presbyterians and the Methodists and this, that, and the other thing. Nonsense. I don't have to be nice to the spirit of the Antichrist. I can love the people who hold false opinions, but I don't have to be nice to them. This is a very intolerant individual who heads up an operation, a very powerful grassroots operation, with extreme right-wing views that most Americans reject. And Lamar Alexander is said here in Londonderry that he would consider him as his running mate. We think this is news. We're not really, we were a little miffed, frankly, that the mainstream media thinks that the price of a dozen eggs and a gallon of milk is more important than Pat Robertson considering, or Lamar Alexander considering Pat Robertson as his running mate.
That was when Lamar Alexander was asked by the mainstream press about questions about the costs of products, and he couldn't answer them.
Right.
What about some of the other questions? For example, lesbian and gay job discrimination.
Well, we asked all of the candidates these questions, and Senator Dole was asked this question in a small town in New Hampshire. He said,
what exactly did you ask him? What did you ask him?
We asked him if he thought that it should be illegal to discriminate against someone if they were gay or lesbian. And he said that he was opposed to discrimination. Later in the day, we followed up on that question and asked him once again. We said, Senator Dole, earlier today you said you were opposed to discrimination. He said, that's right, I'm opposed to discrimination. And our questioner pushed him on it and said, would you endorse legislation which would make it illegal to discriminate against gay men and women? And he turned away from us, and we pushed him on it again, and he said, we're not having a press conference, which in fact he was. So basically refused to answer the question.
What are some of the others? What are some of the other points that you've targeted? For example, Pat Buchanan.
Mr. Buchanan had some interesting things to say about Operation Rescue. We asked all the candidates if they agreed with the political tactics of Operation Rescue, the militant anti-abortion group that blocks clinics and harasses women who are there to seek a legal medical operation. And Mr. Buchanan answered our question by saying he didn't repudiate Operation Rescue. I have a lot of friends in Operation Rescue. And then he went on to compare Operation Rescue's tactics to those used by Dr. Martin Luther King.
Interesting, considering that Pat Buchanan, during his time when he was serving Nixon, had advised Nixon not to go visit the widow King on the first anniversary of King's death, because he said that he was I can't remember exactly the word he used in describing King, but he said something like King was a fraud. He said, arguing the visit would outrage many, many people who believe King was a fraud and a demagogue, and perhaps worse. He said others consider him the devil incarnate. Quite an amazing quote that I got from the Anti-Defamation League's research on
amazing,
Pat Buchanan.
And amazing, but not too shocking now that this Larry Pratt story has come to light. Mr. Buchanan's aide, who has ties to Aryan Nation groups.
Well, let's let's talk about fundamentalism, and let's bring Ken Coleman into this discussion. Ken, you've been a member of the school board in Merrimack, New Hampshire, for a number of years, although you lost that seat for a little while. Can you tell us about how the Christian Coalition is organizing in New Hampshire?
Well, the Christian Coalition started about 3 or 4 years ago, becoming very active in New Hampshire, and they've started typically along their textbook guide, which is to organize in the communities. They've built a lot of their strength around school boards. I was unseated in a Christian Coalition-oriented campaign from my school board seat as chairman of the school board 2 years ago. And this is really where they have built the grassroots to be able to support the candidates of their choosing. It is not a coincidence that the person that unseated me from my school board seat, at least temporarily, and is an activist in the Christian Coalition, is also the county chair of Pat Robertson's campaign.
Does the Christian Coalition have deep roots in New Hampshire? I mean, has it been around for a while?
Well, I don't think it's, you know, first of all, we have to remember this is an organization that started in the end of 1988, so they haven't been around that long. I don't think that they have terribly deep roots, but what they do have is a lot of connections. I don't think the Christian Coalition itself has a lot of membership in New Hampshire, but they've come in with a lot of money because it's first-in-the-nation primary, and if you count the fact that they can network through the fundamentalist churches, and also they ally themselves very closely with groups, everything from the Gun Owners Association, the New Hampshire Right for Life, and some of the militias. And when you put all those together, they end up wielding a fairly significant amount of clout.
So what are the issues that you, as the school board president, you, after you were unseated and then replaced, what are some of the issues that you've been fighting over?
Well, on the local level, we've had fights ever since they took the majority of the board. They tried to put creationism in the school system. Prayer was put in. We've seen attacks on the health curriculum, and the health curriculum basically removed from the school system, censorship of books. The latest one is that our school board has enacted what CBS News referred to as the most severe ban on the discussion of anything to do with homosexuality in the nation in any school district.
What does that involve?
Basically, what it says is that homosexuality can, A, not be discussed or expressed in any type of documentation or speech that has the effect of affirming homosexuality, which basically means you can't have any neutral discussion of it. It has actually censored things like Shakespeare's plays and other things because anything that has a homosexual that's not portrayed in a negative light in a storyline could be deemed as, quote-unquote, having the effect of affirming homosexuality. The other thing it's done, which I think is even more critical, is it removed the ability of students to get counseling. And the significant thing about all this language is that this isn't local Merrimack language or local New Hampshire language. This language came from the failed Smith-Helms Amendment to the 1994 Education Act, and that amendment was promoted by the Christian Coalition.
Right.
And that said,
good point, Ken. This has been promoted all over the country in school boards by local Christian coalitions in efforts to attack the gay and lesbian community.
And so that bill, while it failed, said what?
It was the exact same language, and it's a long couple of paragraphs. So, you know, probably not appropriate that I read them, but basically it goes on to say that schools will not have any materials, literature, discussion, or any other activity that would have the effect of affirming homosexuality. And then it goes on and it says, and no student can be referred to any counseling service that affirms homosexuality.
So even though it wasn't passed federally, at some local school board levels it has been passed and is being enacted, and can also explain why this idea of giving power to the states has become so strong with the Christian Coalition. What about this issue of, now this may seem completely apolitical and have nothing to do with religion, the issue of phonics, Ken?
Well, the issue of phonics actually on the local level has a lot to do with censorship, and this is a little tougher for people to see. It's not as clear-cut as pushing creationism in science class, for instance. But phonics is where you learn to read phonetically without using literature. Most schools today use a combination of both, that you learn phonics, but you also learn a See Dick Run reader is whole language learning, and most schools use a combination of both. The Christian right has been pushing strictly phonics only, And we believe one of the reasons for that is if students are not supposed to in school read literature, that gives a way for them to be able to pull a lot of the literature that they find offensive out of the public schools and in effect censor it by saying you don't need this anymore because this isn't how we're teaching children to read anymore.
I think this could shock a lot of people, the idea that phonics has been made political and the idea that you just learn your ABCs by repeating them and repeating them. I mean, I learned it by having to read story after story after story, and that's what got me interested in reading. Sure, that's true for a lot of people. We're talking to Ken Coleman, member of the school board in Merrimack, New Hampshire, who's been taking on the Christian right for a long time. Actually, he began as a Republican, and your sister is a fundamentalist, isn't she?
That's correct. It's kind of she lives down in Virginia, and it's we have a good relationship, although there's certain issues politically we can't talk about because of the fact that a tremendous amount of anger builds up. And that's one of the problems with bringing this religious agenda into public school systems. Before this came to Merrimack, there were people that disagreed with me over taxation. I tended to be somebody that wanted the support programs, and people would want to cut them. But the day after the school board meeting or the day after our budget was passed, everybody could be civil to one another. When you bring religious issues into the schools, what you do is you make it good. People either are good or evil in people's eyes because religion is not something people can compromise on. And that tears apart a community in a way that it can never be put back together again.
And Galen Nelson, as we wrap up this discussion, I wanted to ask you how people, since we're just beginning the primary season, how people can get involved, how they can ask their candidates questions.
Well, we're going to be returning to Washington to evaluate both the Iowa Expose the Right campaign and the New Hampshire Expose the Right campaign. And, you know, with our limited resources, figure out a way to keep the ball rolling, keep this campaign alive, and help people around the country expose the right at the school board level, at the state level, and of course at the national level. So we may be devising some kind of activist kit or something like that to assist people. In the interim, if people want to call People for the American Way in Washington, we do have an 800 number. It's
326-7329. That's 1-800.
326-7329.
And that way they can find out how they can just go about getting candidate schedules in their state and going to press conferences and citizen
right.
forums.
Right.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. We've been talking to Galen Nelson, director of the New Hampshire Expose the Right campaign, which is a campaign of People for the American Way based in Washington, D.C. And we also want to thank Ken Coleman, member of the school board in Merrimack, New Hampshire, who's been fighting efforts by the Christian right to push its agenda through the public schools. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the living wage campaign in New Hampshire, deciding whether an economy is good based on how high the wages are in the state, not just by the unemployment rate in New Hampshire. In fact, it's quite low. But next up, we're going to be talking about Pat Buchanan's record. We're going to be talking about his anti-Semitism, racism, homophobia, and then we're going to look at his record on labor. This has been talked about a lot in the last few weeks as he talks about his anti-NAFTA stance. He talks about jobs. A lot of people are flocking to his campaign. What do unions think? And also, what do pro-Buchanan activists think, even ones who are in unions? That's what we'll be talking about. This is Democracy Now! Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The media calls him Commentator Pat Buchanan. Many feel he should be identified by his racist, anti-Semitic, and homophobic views. Last week, New Hampshire resident Norm Abelson held a news conference in New Hampshire denouncing his views. Norm Abelson is a longtime New Hampshire resident, a former AP journalist who once worked with Sergeant Shriver in the War on Poverty, and currently is active in homeless shelters and on programs building interfaith relationships. We're also joined by Jeff Cohen, who is Executive Director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and he's going to be talking about why the media doesn't focus on the comments of Buchanan over the last years. But let's begin with Norm Abelson. Norm Abelson, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
And tell us about this news conference you held.
Well, this is the second time we've done it. We did the same thing 4 years ago in the And essentially, we gathered a group of people, mostly members of the clergy and people active in various religious activities, for what we hope would be an educational press conference. It didn't exactly turn out that way.
What happened?
Well, it kept trying to move in the direction of people asking me did I think that Buchanan was like Adolf Hitler. I tried to say that what we're really trying to do is put Buchanan's statements on the record, things that he himself had said and things that friends of his and supporters of his had said about his various views on Jews, blacks, gays, immigration, so forth.
Well, why don't you share some of those views, since in this campaign, these views, while they got some attention in 1992, seemed to be almost entirely sanitized by the press.
Well, that's unfortunately true. Let me just quickly give you a few examples. With regard to black people, Patrick Buchanan wrote that the deaths of a dozen white Europeans would be more shocking than a massacre of black people in Burundi. He also said he would prefer the immigration of a million white Englishmen to a million black Zulus because whites are who we are in this country. It seems like Buchanan's anti-immigration policies become more intense as the percentage of black and brown immigrants increases. About the AIDS epidemic, he said it was nature's retribution to gays because it was preventable. Buchanan has had nothing to say about the millions of people who die from smoking and drinking, which also are preventable. About Jews, he called Hitler an individual of great courage with extraordinary gifts. And he also said that half of the survivors' testimonies at the major Holocaust memorial in Israel are unreliable. He claimed that survivors suffer from fantasies of martyrdom and heroics. My wife is a survivor of Auschwitz. There are no fantasies about what happened to her there. And that's a good reason why Alan Ryan, who was head of the U.S. Justice Department's Office of Special Investigation, called Buchanan the spokesman for Nazi war criminals in America.
Didn't he also have a comment to make about Klaus Barbie, the well-known Nazi war criminal?
Yes, he did. When the United States apologized to France for sheltering all those years this miserable Nazi henchman, Buchanan said, quote, "To what end all this wallowing in the atrocities of a dead Nazi regime?"
Norm Abelson, you're a longtime resident of New Hampshire. You've certainly been following this campaign. Are we seeing some of these quotes in the media, at least in New Hampshire?
None. Unfortunately, what happened at the press conference was I kept getting questions about Mr. Larry Pratt, who was one of the co-chairmen of Buchanan's campaign and arguably maybe a white supremacist. I think the media has missed the whole point. I don't think it's a question of whether Mr. Pratt ever attended a white racist meeting. It's a question of what drew him to Patrick Buchanan's campaign. The media sort of refuses to focus in on that, spending endless time on Mr. Pratt, who isn't running for a damn thing, and spending not a minute on what draws people like him to Buchanan and his campaign.
I thought it was interesting when I saw Larry Pratt commenting after he was kicked out, at least for the time being, under pressure of Pat Buchanan's campaign. He said that, yes, he had been to meetings where there were white Aryans, but he also had to work with feminists, also people he doesn't like. Jeff Cohen is another guest on Democracy Now! Today. He's Executive Director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Jeff, why isn't the media focusing on this kind of hate speech that we've been hearing for so long from Pat Buchanan?
Well, I would say part of the problem is that the pundit elite on television and in the media are so close to Patrick Buchanan, he's a friend of theirs, that they can't perceive him in the way he's perceived by so many groups in our country. If a lot of Jews, a lot of gays and lesbians, a lot of women, a lot of blacks, a lot of Latinos, they see him as a bigot, as a racist. They look at all these quotes. It's been in the Jewish press. It's been in the black press. It's been in the feminist press, the gay press. And these communities know and fear Patrick Buchanan. On the other hand, the people that work with him every day, remember Patrick Buchanan is a television star. That's his vehicle for becoming a presidential candidate and a leading presidential candidate. He was on CNN's Crossfire off and on for 15 years. He was on the McLaughlin Group off and on for about 13 years. He was on Capital Gang on CNN. He's been on all of these shows week after week for many, many years. And the pundits who work with him just do not perceive him in the way that these various communities do. Here's Fred Barnes, who is a fellow McLaughlin Group resident with Buchanan. Underneath it is a really nice guy, actually a sweet person. That's Fred Barnes on Buchanan. Here's Michael Kinsley. He's a much nicer fellow than I expected. Here's Al Hunt, a very civil, even a very, very kind man, talking about Patrick Buchanan. And, you know, maybe he's a sweet guy, you know, when you get to talk to him for a half hour and then go away from a show. But that's not how Buchanan's perceived by all of these groups who Buchanan has been attacking in column after column for the last some 15 years or so.
That's right. They all share one characteristic, two characteristics. They're white and they're men, not exactly two of the qualities that he's been attacking.
Right.
Well, I'm sitting here looking at the ADL Special Research Report from 1992. It's the Anti-Defamation League, called From Columnist to Candidate, Pat Buchanan's Religious War. And each page is more astounding than the one before it. I'm looking at Pat Buchanan's views on South Africa, and it says that he's traditionally admired and defended Pretoria's white regime, which he's often referred to as the Boer Republic after the Dutch natives who colonized the region. And in 1990, he derided those who believed white rule of a black majority is inherently wrong. He said, where do we get that idea? The founding fathers did not believe this. They did not give Indians, who are still living a tribal existence, the right to vote us out of North America. And he goes on from there. Right. Also, it points out that in 1965, Buchanan joined Richard Nixon's campaign, and that documents obtained from the Nixon archives by Boston Globe and U.S. News and World Report reveal Buchanan to have been an opponent of government-sponsored integration and unsympathetic to black people generally, and then talks about his anti-integration views. John Ehrlichman, White House aide, well-known to Nixon, said, no good politics in Pat Buchanan's extreme view, segregation forever.
Right. You know, one of the internal memos that was released that Buchanan had written to Nixon when he was in the Nixon White House, it was a reference to a magazine article in The Atlantic about the genetic basis of intelligence, and this is what Buchanan called it, a seminal piece of major significance for U.S. society. And then Buchanan wrote to Nixon, it shows that, quote, integration of blacks and whites, but even more so poor and well-to-do, is less likely to result in accommodation than it is in perpetual friction, as the incapable are placed consciously by government side by side with the capable, unquote. I mean, frankly, one can go through Buchanan's career and find serious patterns, not just on bigotry against racial groups, but almost a questioning of democracy. And, you know, in his autobiography, Right from the Beginning is the name of it, Right from the Beginning, Buchanan writes about, he waxes nostalgic about the heroes that his dad has, and basically implies that they're his heroes. And his dad's heroes were General Francisco Franco of Spain and Senator Joseph McCarthy. And when you look at Buchanan's writings later, long after his father was not the dominant person in his life, you see that these same anti-democratic views are easy to find in Buchanan's writings. One could call them authoritarian views, For example, he once wrote a column about Franco and Chile's general Pinochet, both military dictators who terminated democracy in their countries. And in a column by Buchanan in 1989, they became, quote, soldier patriots. And, you know, what's curious to me about all of these quotes of Buchanan where he's sort of putting down democracy, he's got quotes where he talks about how people are overly obsessed with democracy, and he attacked the, quote, one-man, one-vote Earl Warren system in one article. Here's another one. Like all idolatries, democratism substitutes a false god for the real, a love of process for a love of country, the democratist temptation, the worship of democracy as a form of governance, you know, and he goes on and attacks
that. Can I get a word in here?
Yes, Norm Abelson.
I think we're moving. What Jeff's saying is right, and of course he does it on a full-time basis. I'm just a citizen. There's no question that Patrick J. Buchanan, and I'll say it straight, he's a coward, he's a liar, and he's a bigot. Part of the problem is those of us on our side, the liberals, one of the lead editorials in the Boston Globe today by Thomas Oliphant, an admitted left-wing liberal writer, the headline says, the smear against Buchanan, guilt by association. And he the whole column supports Patrick Buchanan, decries everyone speaking against him, and ends up by saying this: for those Republicans who still despise guilt by association and have been disgusted by the bilge of the past week, there is an easy way to show it when they vote today. Here's Thomas Oliphant in the Boston Globe, owned by the New York Times, today telling people in my state of New Hampshire to vote for Patrick J. Buchanan. This is outrageous.
Yeah, I think you were hitting at what the issue is, that the problem with the media coverage is that it keeps asking, is Buchanan attracting extremists and racists? When the real question is, given this record of commentary and column writing for 15 years, is Buchanan himself a racist
and
an extremist?
Can I just quote two friends of his in the media? Just very briefly, William Safire, who works for the New York Times and who worked with Nixon, worked with him in the Nixon administration, calls Buchanan, quote, a most likable hater. And I think most telling of all were the comments of William F. Buckley, who's Buchanan's old friend and fellow traveler in the right. Writing in his own National Review after a long investigation, Buckley wrote about a 35-page takeout on Buchanan's history and writings, and I read it. And here's Buckley's conclusion, quote, I find it impossible to defend Pat Buchanan against the charge that what he did and said amounted to anti-Semitism. These are two people who work with him, who know him. I'll tell you something, it may sound paranoid to you, but he was the chief trickster in the Nixon campaign. And the fact that Patrick Buchanan himself may have set up this Pratt situation, so that on the one hand he could say, no, I'm not a racist, but send one of his smirking messages to the right wing, wouldn't surprise me one bit.
Wasn't he also involved in the Reagan campaign during the Reagan presidency in setting up Reagan's visit to Bitburg to honor the Nazi SS?
Yes, he was. He wrote
SS.
The speech, and he's the one that convinced Reagan to go to Bitburg.
Norm Abelson, we're going to have to end this segment. We're staying on with Jeff Cohen to talk more about the issue of labor and Pat Buchanan. But I want to ask you, I mean, do you really think Pat Buchanan is going to be president?
I think people laugh too much about whether Reagan could become the nominee and whether Reagan could become president, and he did. I feel that when I look at the weak field that Buchanan is going against, and you might in a sense have Lamar Alexander and Dole splitting votes, and then Buchanan's not splitting votes because I think some of the right-wingers are either not players or they're going to fall out of the race, the far rightists. I think Buchanan could really make a play for this nomination.
And that is Jeff Cohen, who's Executive Director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And we're also joined right now on the telephone by Joe Palau, who is a postal worker, union member, and a strong Buchanan supporter in New York. He's a Bronx native and comes from what, your mother comes from Puerto Rico?
My father.
Your father comes from Puerto Rico, Joe. What are your comments as you hear this conversation?
Well, the anti-Semitic charge, and I'm Hispanic, I know Pat Buchanan. I've been to his home. He's been to mine when he was up in the Bronx campaign. In fact, he started his New York State campaign in the South Bronx, where he held a $10,000 fundraiser from working-class people. I think this is like the liberal media and people in the establishment who just are afraid of his ideas and are trying to dig up everything they have on him. Jesse Jackson, who has a good worker agenda, also they dug up some a lot of stuff on him too, and the liberal media treats him like a king.
So do you think he's being attacked because of his views, and we're now just beginning to get into them, on NAFTA and jobs, the only candidate who is against the North American Free Trade Agreement?
Definitely. Definitely. What I think the establishment is afraid of is someone who is really looking out for the regular people, the American people, and they're just trying to discredit him. I could give you some quotes that he said positive about Israel, you know, where he supports Israel. And being anti-Israel is not being anti-Semitic.
Let me ask you about a comment he made the other night. I guess it was reported on New Hampshire TV. They had him talking about immigration and his comment, "Go away, Jose." What do you make of that?
Okay, again, coming from someone who's half Hispanic, my father was born and raised in Puerto Rico. He came here when he was 22 years old. The majority of illegal aliens are coming in from Mexico.
In fact, the majority of illegal immigrants come in from Europe.
Well, they shouldn't be here either. The perceived notion is that most of these illegal aliens are coming in from Mexico. And Pat was just saying it, hey, you know, Jose, go back home. And I don't see anything racial with that at all. In fact, my father's name is Jose. And if you are here legally, if you come to the United States legally, you deserve to be here. You deserve every right as an American. You are an American. But the ones that are coming in here illegally are taking away American jobs from the American people, black or white. And I think it should be stopped. And Pat Buchanan will be the guy to stop it. Coming from Europe and Mexico.
Joe, you say he's pro-labor. What makes you think that?
Well, I spoke to him in the past. I spoke to Pat, and we had a lot of discussions on unions and labor. And that's why you see him taking a hardball policy toward Japan. It's because of Japan dumping their cars on us that a lot of union people in the automotive unions are out of work now. Foreign steel, a lot of steel workers are out of jobs. Textile people in the South are a lot of jobs. And most of them, as Pat's been saying, are single women in South Carolina, North Carolina. They're all looking for jobs or on welfare. And it ain't right.
Let's turn to Phil Wheeler, who we're going to go on with after this segment closes. You're director of Region 9A of the United Auto Workers, and you've been in New Hampshire working with the UAW on political trainings. Do you feel that Pat Buchanan is pro-labor?
No, I don't think he is. I think that it's quite obvious. I don't know how you can say that you're pro-labor or for the working people when President Reagan fired the air traffic controllers, he supported that. He also was against the 1993 Family Medical Leave Act, which was signed into law by President Clinton. And he's been clear on his position on minimum wage. He's against that, increasing the minimum wage. And he's also opposed to any kind of protection for strikers, the Striker Replacement Act. So I don't see how anybody can conclude that a person with that kind of positions is for working people.
Joe Palau?
Well, getting back to the air traffic controllers, they had a clause in their contract they couldn't strike. They're federal workers. I'm a federal worker, and we can't strike, and that's why they were fired. The minimum wage and some of the other issues that gentleman has brought up, getting back to the minimum wage, once Pat Buchanan's economic policies are in the United States, you'll see the minimum wage start going up. Right now, and it's been reported by think tanks also, you can't compete with a 50 cents an hour Mexican worker, an Asian worker, on minimum wage. They'll wipe us out.
We're going to move on with this discussion in just a minute. You're listening to Joe Palau, who's a postal worker in New York and Buchanan supporter. Also, Phil Wheeler with the United Auto Workers and Jeff Cohen, executive director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, which is a media watch group based in New York. Coming up, we want to ask Phil Wheeler about his experience in New Hampshire organizing the UAW at the same time in the same hotel that a pro-Buchanan rally was taking place and the kind of conversations that you had there. You're listening to Democracy Now. Stay with us. And you're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica's national grassroots election show. Coming up in a little while, we're going to talk about the living wage campaign that's going on in New Hampshire. Right now, we're continuing on a debate around Pat Buchanan's labor record. In the last few days, I mean, there have been quite some startling comments, or at least presidential candidate Bob Dole, the Senate Majority Leader, seems to be very surprised at a rally he held where he was talking to 300 workers. He said he was surprised that jobs and trade have become the issue. And in fact, he was crediting Buchanan a little on that. Well, I don't think it's surprising that jobs and trade are something that people are concerned about. But Jeff Cohen, let me ask you before we go on to the pro-Buchanan rally in New Hampshire and what labor activists did there. Let me ask you about the media and how it's covered NAFTA and jobs and how you deal with Pat Buchanan's anti-NAFTA stance, the only candidate, including President Clinton, who is opposed and has expressed strong opposition to the North American Free Trade Agreement.
Well, I think that economic nationalism or protectionism alone does not make an economic program. So what the mainstream media, if they were doing their job, would be doing is asking him all of these questions about striker replacement and federal minimum wage. The minimum wage doesn't just glide up on its own. It's set by the federal government, and Buchanan's against raising it. So I just think that the specifics of what is your program, it's pure rhetoric. He can talk about the American worker 29 times in a speech, but his program is actually anti-worker. And, you know, that last speech he gave, which was quoted widely in New York Times and on Nightline, here's what he says. What is my party doing, hauling all the water for the fat cats on K Street? What are we doing? That's not the party of Ronald Reagan, unquote. Well, if you're running for president today and all your TV commercials feature Ronald Reagan, a man who presided over the greatest redistribution of wealth from American working-class people and middle-class people to the rich and to big business, and there's a contradiction there, an obvious one that even mainstream reporters should be able to see, which is how can you pretend to be for getting more wealth and more share of income to working-class Americans when you're still embracing Reaganomics?
Speaking of fat cats, Jeff, in a little while we're going to be speaking with a member of a New Hampshire political theater group called just that, the Fat Cats, and exposing these kind of views throughout the New Hampshire primary. But what about the mainstream media and its stance on NAFTA? I don't think it's surprising that Bob Dole is surprised people care about NAFTA.
Right. I think what's happened, if you look in the New York Times, there have been front page stories going back several months that talk about Patrick Buchanan and his reckless views on trade, his extremist views on trade. The fact is, when Buchanan was getting anything resembling negative or critical coverage months ago, it was purely because many in the mainstream media are biased in favor of NAFTA and GATT. But in those early articles about Buchanan and his wacky policies, the words race, racism, bigotry were almost impossible to find. But yes, the mainstream media, as Fair has documented in studies, is pro-NAFTA. It's pro, quote, free trade. But I believe that their biggest flaw in covering Buchanan, besides giving him almost a free ride on bigotry up through the Larry Pratt incident, is that they don't ask him, what is your policy? And then I think if they did, American workers, whether union members or not, would realize that this guy talks the rhetoric of workers, but he still, aside from NAFTA, is putting forward the economics of Reaganomics.
Let's move on to Phil Wheeler, again, director of Region 9A, United Auto Workers. You've been in New Hampshire working with UAW members. Can you tell us about the event at the hotel, the pro-Buchanan rally that took place in the same place you were doing a training?
Yes, that was on Sunday, and Buchanan was having his rally in the same hotel. So some of our members decided they wanted to go in and see what he had to say and ask him some questions. And so when they got in there, he started talking about NAFTA and how he thought that, you know, he really supported working people. So one of them asked the question, what about striker replacement? When he asked that question, he went on to talk about his pro-life position. When he got back on the NAFTA again, the same person asked again, what about your position on striker replacement? And he changed the subject again. And the third time the question was asked, a couple of Buchanan supporters came over and told him he had to leave and escorted him out of the room. And then a little while later, another one of the, our members asked a question about minimum wage. And Buchanan didn't answer that question either. And he asked it again. And two other campaign people came over and told him if he said anything again, he'd be asked to leave. So he walked out. So it's pretty hard to understand or why anybody would think that this is a person that supports working people when working people ask the questions that concern him and they're asked to leave a rally that's open to the public. And he refused to respond to those questions.
Joe Palau, this doesn't jive with what you are saying about what Pat Buchanan represents.
I wasn't at the rally up in New Hampshire, so I really can't, you know, really go into that. But when Japan sells us, I think it's 400,000, when Japan buys 400,000 American-made cars and they sell us 40 million, there's something definitely wrong. And this is from 1970. Pat Buchanan's the only candidate in which to change this. And that's why I'm backing him as a worker.
I don't think that's the case, that Buchanan's the only one that wants to change it. President Clinton has been clear on problems of the exports and imports from Japan.
Well, as
and
as
has
a
been trying to do something about it. The problem is, I mean, here's Buchanan who drove a Mercedes for years, and he's yelling and talking about the problem of imports. He didn't support the position of American workers when he was driving that Mercedes. He didn't care about us at that point. Now that he thinks it's a politically right position to be taken, he's up there in a soapbox talking about exports and imports.
I want to bring Mark McKenzie into this discussion, president of the New Hampshire State AFL-CIO and full-time firefighter. So, Mark, just let us know if a fire erupts so that you can go save someone.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Well, what about the working people of New Hampshire? What do you see as your issues? Is Pat Buchanan addressing them?
Well, I mean, I think that... As Rick Trombley, who's a Democratic leader in New Hampshire, said a few days ago to Vice President Gore when we had a chance to meet with him, the issues in New Hampshire are about security. It's about job security. It's about wage security. It's about health security, health care security. It's about retirement security. It's about living in a community in which you can get a decent job and afford some sense of a quality of life. And those are really the issues in New Hampshire, an economy that has been devastated, and I've been involved in a lot of campaigns, a lot of presidential campaigns. I can remember the days when Pat Buchanan and other people would have met thousands of workers in the mills of Manchester in heavy manufacturing and textiles and shoes and other things. Today, there's no stops by any of the presidential candidates or any of those things because they're gone, as well as thousands of jobs at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard have gone, as well as places like Wang and Digital and other places who have reduced the workforce. We have a workforce in New Hampshire that is in transition, and it's going someplace that none of us are real comfortable the direction it's going. It's not going towards high-wage, high-skilled jobs, but rather towards an economy that is really small business. Small business is not paying very well, and people are nervous about the future.
Mm-hmm. But what about Joe Palau's comment that he thinks all the attacks on Pat Buchanan are a way to discredit him because of his strong anti-NAFTA staff position, and that the establishment and the corporations, they don't want to hear from it?
Well, let me first say that, for any of for Joe and for Phil and other people that are in the labor movement, I think it's a victory for us that the fact that Pat Buchanan from the Republican Party is forcing Bob Dole and other people to talk about working class issues. And I think we should take some credit for that because we're the ones, the labor movement, has been beating up on these guys for a long period of time to talk about those working class issues. Do I think that Pat Buchanan from the Republican Party talks about his position after makes Republicans nervous? I think it makes them very nervous, and it should, because for the longest time, Bob Dole and other people have ignored working men and women in this country, and it's time that they have to look at changing that mix and changing that the whole power structure within this. So I think that it's a victory in one sense for us that need to talk about that. And I heard somebody mention the union the quote that was on the page of the Union Leader today, where Bob Dole talks about never realizing jobs and trade would be a major issue in the campaign. I said that they were a major issue in the campaign a year and a half ago, and they continue to be, as they will be around the country. Pat Buchanan is making people nervous. The problem with Pat Buchanan, from my perspective, however, is that, Pat has been, I live in New Hampshire, I live in Manchester, the biggest community in the state. I have an office in Concord, the second busiest community in the state of New Hampshire. I've never seen Pat Buchanan. I represent more workers in more industries than anybody else in the state of New Hampshire. And Pat Buchanan, with the exception of one call that they made on Saturday, some staff member made to my house, Pat Buchanan has never reached out to working men and women, certainly never reached out to organized labor within the state of New Hampshire. And I think it undermines his credibility with working men and women when the people that represent the AFL-CIO who represents working men and women, he doesn't contact us. That's a real problem for him and his campaign, I think.
Joe Palau, you're a union man. You're in a union. What do you feel about this? You're also pro-Buchanan.
I agree with what he said, and I think it was a mistake for the campaign up in New Hampshire not to get some outreach into the...
Joe, turn your radio down because...
I have a radio on.
Oh, sorry.
It's not me. I agree with everything he just said, and the campaign would be at fault for not reaching out to some of the unions up there in New Hampshire.
It sounds like the criticism is beyond not reaching out, but also specific stances he has taken. For example, not supporting the Family Medical Leave Act, not supporting minimum wage, or also not being against replacement workers. What do you think of these positions?
Well, I didn't know his position on the replacement workers. I'm going to bring that up when I see him in New York. And Pat Buchanan has evolved. From his stance 10, 20 years ago, he was a free trader. And when he went out campaigning in 92, he saw what everyone was going through, especially up in New Hampshire. I was up in New Hampshire back in 92. And Pat Buchanan has evolved. His whole economic policy has evolved into what it is today. And I'm sure some of the other issues that we might not agree with them now on will evolve also.
Joe, just before you go, what does Pat Buchanan's house look like? You said you visited it.
Yeah, it's down in McLean, and everyone would think that's a big mansion. So, like, it's a nice home. Nice home, really nice.
Well, Joe Palau, I want to thank you for joining us, and we're going to continue now on the discussion of labor in New Hampshire. We are talking about Pat Buchanan's record, but we also want to talk about just what is going on with wages, with employment in New Hampshire. And again, we are joined by Mark McKenzie, president of New Hampshire State AFL-CIO, a fireman who might leave us at any point. And we also have on line with us Phil Wheeler, with the United Auto Workers, who's been in New Hampshire organizing UAW members. And we've been joined by Judy Elliott, who is an economist with New Hampshire Citizen Action, who has been studying the employment trends in the state. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Judy.
Good morning.
I want to ask you about the economy, both in Iowa and New Hampshire. The journalists have been saying that the economy is good. They say unemployment is very low. What's your take on New Hampshire?
Well, in New Hampshire, it's true that the unemployment rate is very low. In December of 1995, it was 3.1%, which is terrific, of course. But the problem is that the jobs that we're creating in New Hampshire tend to be in low-wage industries, and we continue to lose employment in high-wage industries.
Why do we hear that the economy is good when people are on the ground aren't feeling that?
Well, I mean, I think if you ask a worker who's looking for employment, they will tell you that, sure, it's easy to get a job. You can go to a fast food place or a service establishment, and it's very easy to get a job. But the problem is that the quality of the job is low in terms of the wage paid, in terms of the benefits available, in terms of the stability of the employment. It tends to be that many jobs are created in part-time or temporary areas. So what we're seeing is that there's no problem for workers to find employment, but finding employment that will really support a family is getting trickier and trickier for workers.
Tell us about the living wage campaign in New Hampshire.
Well, New Hampshire folks who are concerned about the problem of declining job quality have been looking at examples from other states and looking at examples of coalitions of community, labor, religious groups who have gotten together to say that, yes, employment is a problem for everybody, that in order to have stable families and good communities, we need to have high-wage jobs. So we're starting to pull together that sort of a coalition in New Hampshire and hoping to do it specifically in Manchester, our biggest industrial city, to address the problems of the workers who are most vulnerable. In other words, young workers, single heads of households, immigrants, and try and see what we can do to improve the status of those workers.
Mark McKenzie, what do you consider a living wage?
I think Judy hit on it. You know, in Manchester, the biggest community, I think it's a wage that provides a certain amount of security to the people in the community. It gives them enough to be able to buy a house or to rent a decent apartment in the community. It gives them enough money to be able to get health care or have a retirement and have some sense of security about their job and about the community. Living wage is about security. And it's about sufficient amounts of money and sufficient security to be able to live a decent life in a community like Manchester, New Hampshire. And
I know that New York City, Sal Albanese, the city council member, introduced a living wage resolution where the city would not contract with contractors who didn't pay a living wage, not the minimum wage. That didn't pass. I believe in Baltimore it has.
Judy, I think, is probably more up to that. I know that there's been a number of campaigns around the country, and I think Baltimore is one of them. I think there might have been one down in Philadelphia, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe Judy can respond.
Baltimore did pass a living wage ordinance saying that any contractor who sells services to the cities must pay a living wage, and that living wage is going to go up over the years. But there are also living wage campaigns in Buffalo, Milwaukee, Minnesota. And it's a spreading trend. It looks like a tactic that is being employed successfully in a number of places.
Judy, on a lighter note, we only have 30 seconds. I hear you're a member of the New Hampshire political theater group called Fat Cats. What are you doing?
Well, we are portraying the special interests who buy political candidates, so we dress up in fat cat suits and go out and hand out fake $500 bills. It's a terrific season to buy a candidate.
Judy Elliott, thank you very much for joining us,
sure.
Economist with New Hampshire Citizen Action. We also want to thank Mark McKenzie, president of the New Hampshire State AFL-CIO and full-time firefighter. And I'm glad to let our listeners know that during the time we spoke, there were no fires, at least in Mark's vicinity. And finally, I want to thank Phil Wheeler, who's with the United Auto Workers, for joining us for this segment as well. And I want to let people know that Democracy Now! Is Pacifica's national election show, and it's available to community radio stations all over the country. Now, you're hearing it, so you know that we're available to you. But if you have friends in other cities, other communities that don't hear Democracy Now!, tell them to call their community or public radio station and let them know Pacifica's Democracy Now! Is available to build democracy around this country. That's it for today's edition of Democracy Now! Our show is produced by Julie Drizin with assistance from Pat Greenfield. Our engineers are Kenneth Mason and Bob Daughtry at the studios of Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C. Special thanks to John O'Leary. I'm Amy Goodman. Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky will be joining me tomorrow for analysis of the results from the New Hampshire primary. I hope you'll join us, too, on Democracy Now!